Andalak County versus SNW. Attorney Sanders Drazen, are you prepared to begin?
I am.
Please do.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Megan Sanders Drazen and I represent SNW. This case started with an emergency detention. The statement of emergency detention said my client was a danger to himself. The testimony and the argument at the probable cause hearing again raised that concern that my client was a danger to himself. A couple weeks later, just 2 days before trial, the first examination report came in. It once again said my client was a danger to himself. It was not until the day before trial that my client and his trial attorney were put on notice that the county might try to prove that he was a danger to others. That notice came in the report that was filed late by Dr. Bales. The statute we are here to talk about, Section 5120.10b, guarantees defense counsel 48 hours of access to the reports court-appointed examiners submit. Those reports will be the heart of the county's case, if not the whole thing. 48 hours is the bare minimum the legislature has said defense counsel must have with that critical evidence. The burning question this case presents, there are a few different questions, but the key one is what should the circuit court have done when the undisputed statutory violation of Dr. Bales' late filed report occurred? Both prior cases and the practical necessity of timely access to these reports when preparing for trial show the circuit court should have dismissed the case because it lacked competency. But even if it didn't, even if the court retained competency, some remedy is needed to make the right to 48 hours access real. Excluding the late report and the expert's testimony protects the due process rights that the 48-hour rule serves without hamstringing the county in its effort to prove its case. The circuit court should have granted SNW's motion for that reasonable remedy. I want to delve a little bit further into competency in a moment. I do just want to note there are two additional issues besides this 48-hour rule issue, dangerousness and mootness, and I will address those issues briefly towards the end of my time, time permitting.
Counsel, when your client became ill, or at least it appeared that he was having problems, he was an inmate in Dodge County Jail, correct?
He wasn't serving a sentence, but he was confined in Dodge County Jail, I believe on a probation hold.
Okay, so he was, but that's where he was.
Correct.
Okay, and was the cause of his confinement terminated before the hearing that you're speaking about?
My understanding is that it was.
Okay, can you tell me where in the record? Because I tried to find it. Nobody said anything about it in the briefs, and I couldn't find it. So
I agree with that. I would say it is implied in the record. It is not explicitly addressed in the record that the probation hold was lifted.
How is it implied?
Well, it's implied by, at the probable cause hearing, there is discussion of, or maybe it's the hearing on the change of venue motion. There's discussion that if my client is released from Winnebago County, he'd go back to the Dodge County Jail. Right. That is the last mention of the Dodge County Jail, that appears in the record. And it is clarified in the record that he was there on a probation hold. And so simply by virtue of there being no further reference to the Dodge County Jail or to the probation hold or to anything like that, my impression from the record is that it was lifted. The hold was lifted.
I see. Okay.
Returning to competency, there is
just... I want to ask about 5120.10c and what we're supposed to do with that text. Mm-hmm. So I understand your arguments both on competency and even if not competency, what is the proper remedy? And this may play into both of those questions or may not, but I want to give you an opportunity to weigh into that. But it's noteworthy to me that right after the requirement in sub B that there should be access to all the reports 48 hours in advance, that we have C immediately following. And it says the court shall, in every stage of an action. So to just pause there for a minute, I'm reading that, say this is a mandatory requirement for the court, and it applies from the beginning of the proceeding to the end of the proceeding, including, you know, in submission of reports potentially. Disregard any error or defect in the pleadings or proceedings. Violating sub B would seem to be an error in the defect or error or defect in the proceedings. I shall disregard that if it does not affect the substantial rights of either party. It seems to me that either this does not apply to B. Maybe your argument is that, or it doesn't apply with any force. But I'm trying to figure out what to do with that language, because I'm reading that language. B doesn't say what to do if there's a violation, and C says what to do if there's any violation of anything. And C says the court needs to disregard it. So what am I supposed to do with that text, and how does it interact with your arguments? And putting aside even the way the Court of Appeals or your opposing counsel argue, I just love to hear kind of your perspective of the range of options that, you know, we have in terms of giving faithful meaning to that text.
First of all, Justice Hagedorn, I don't see anything in the text in sub C that says sub B is not within its, under its umbrella, right? So I see sub C as applying universally to the proceedings under this chapter. That said, it references the substantial rights of either party. And my position is that the 48-hour rule grants access to examination reports at least 48 hours in advance of final hearing. It could be longer, but it guarantees that period of time, that brief window of access to examination reports, and that in doing so, it makes the rights referenced in sub A, I believe it is. No, maybe it's different subsection. But in any case, the rights to effective assistance of counsel, the rights to present and cross-examine witnesses, it makes those rights meaningful. Those rights, the right to act to have effective assistance of counsel, cannot be effectuated unless counsel has time to prepare. And to me, the prejudice of granting counsel less than 48 hours, less than the brief window the legislature has guaranteed, the prejudice is intrinsic to the shortened window of access to those reports. And I think hitting home the significance of these reports, I don't know that I properly conveyed in my briefs just how critical these reports are in an original commitment proceeding. I mean, they're critical across the board, okay? But in an original commitment proceeding, these reports can be everything. They can be all the notice a counsel has to the allegations and the expert opinions that they are tasked with defending against at trial.
Let me just ask a follow-up. So suppose you're right most of the time. It seems like you're arguing, because I agree, the legislature clearly has set up a rule to protect the rights of people like your client, and that's certainly what that 40-hour rule is for. But what it seems like you're asking us to do is to adopt a blanket rule that it is always the case that any violation of that statute would always require that evidence to be removed. And I'm not sure how that compares to the language of C. So again, I don't mean to operate in extremes, but that's what we do, right? When we're applying rules, they need to apply to all kinds of situations. So suppose counsel is putting the report up, but there's a technical problem or forgets to hit the right button, you know, to make it available. Counsel lets them know it's 5 minutes late. From the time that he was expecting it. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me at least theoretically possible that such a scenario would not affect the substantial rights mm-hmm. of the party. But your rule would require that to be dismissed. So even if you're right on the broad policy strokes, I'm struggling with sort of the blanket rule and how that compares to the language of the statute, which does not. If you're agreeing that C applies to B, it does not seem to apply quite so black and white.
Two concerns that I would hope you would consider in thinking through that problem, Justice Hagedorn. One is, imagine the situation if we say, okay, even if you're deprived of 48 hours access, you need to offer particularized proof of prejudice. Okay, then we come before the circuit court, and what exactly are we showing? What we haven't had time to delve into the report necessarily. So how do we show what weaknesses we want to research and consider? We haven't researched those weaknesses or considered them carefully. And so how do we know what impact that might have on the court's conclusion? We haven't gone to trial. Maybe we will retain our freedom despite this problem. And so asking defense counsel to speculate as to the damage her shortened window of access to the 48 hours or to the examination reports will cause, I think raises a lot of practical problems. I think it's going to cause confusion at the circuit court level, trying to figure out how much preparation is enough under due process. In the sliding scale between 48 hours and 0 minutes, you know, where do we draw the line?
Ms. Sanders-Drazen, let me just stop you there, because don't we do something similar if we think about the discovery statute in 971.23? And we say, look, you need to turn over witness lists. You need to turn over discovery to the other side. And if you don't, that evidence or that person will be excluded except for good cause. And then someone needs to talk about how that hurts them. And it's the same things you're talking about. It's a bit speculative because you don't have that information yet. You need to talk about how you might use it. But in this instance, like you said, right, these reports are important. You know that for every single Chapter 51 initial commitment, how important these reports are, whether we're talking about a specific case or some hypothetical case that might come to your desk next week. So I understand your argument. I appreciate your argument, but I've just seen it play out in a slightly different arena under 971.23. So how is this different?
I wish that I had 971.23 in front of me, but one thing you just mentioned in reciting its contents is good cause. There is no provision saying you can delay your filing of the examination report for good cause. So I think that sticking with the statutory text and determining which statutes sort of contemplate that there will be exceptions and which statutes don't, and which statutes contemplate that when they are not followed, it won't necessarily end the case or automatically result in exclusion, and which statutes don't, I think that's important. And I think that sort of distinction is one place the Court of Appeals paid insufficient attention to the statutory text. The statutes that it found most relevant in its analysis of the competency issue were statutes that expressly say you do not lose jurisdiction if this one isn't followed. If I can just circle back one moment, I had wanted to make two points with regard to Justice Hagedorn's set of concerns. And one was, the practical problem of dealing with proving prejudice in the circuit court. And the second is, and Justice Kurofsky, this goes a bit to your question as well. It's true that there are a variety of circumstances in the criminal law and elsewhere where particularized prejudice has to be shown. It is also true that there are circumstances in which we presume prejudice. We presume prejudice across the board, regardless of whether in a particular case, it was in fact suffered. And the reason we presume prejudice, I'm thinking of situations, for example, if a defense attorney does not effectuate their client's goals by telling the jury that the client is innocent, if a prosecutor breaches a plea agreement at a sentencing hearing. You know, there are a variety of circumstances in which we say the error is of a kind that it makes no sense to look at the particulars. It is too hard to ascertain what would a sentencing court have done. And it is too hard to ascertain what would a defense attorney have been able to accomplish with that full period of time.
Counsel, can I take that presumption idea a little further, though? And if we actually look at sub C, is it possible that there could be a presumption here, but that that presumption is rebuttable? And that that's maybe where sub C fits into this picture? That, yes, the legislature set forth the 48 hours, the counsel shall have access, and sub C comes in when it talks about substantial rights. So, for example, what if we had a case unlike this one, where there are two doctors, as there are here, but where the court said something like, I rely on this other doctor, and that's where I'm mostly relying on. And so there is no need for that. That right is overcome. The substantial rights are not affected. Maybe that's a bad example because you could almost dismiss the report there. But or another situation where it's very clear what the conduct is of the individual through other means that the defense counsel has been aware of somehow. I can think of other scenarios, but what do you think about incorporating sub C as a means of a rebuttable presumption? How does that fit into your argument?
I'm having a little trouble understanding the rebuttable presumption position, but if I can just quickly address, the idea that if we wait through trial and it turns out there's another psychiatrist that provides sufficient testimony, you know, we don't have to rely on that sort of waiting means that we can't make the initial decision at the outset whether or not to exclude the report. And so I would say, you know, that what we're talking about in terms of exclusion is something that happens before trial. And so we can't know what trial would look like.
I'm not talking about waiting. Maybe okay. I wasn't clear. I'm building off of Justice Hagedorn's question. And
okay.
In the affirmative that 5120 sub 10C does apply.
Mm-hmm.
We have to apply it. Perhaps it does, perhaps it doesn't, but you're agreeing that it does. And so if it does, what does it mean? It can't possibly mean that always, every single time, if it's 48 hours, that's it, unless we say that that's a substantial right to have the report within 48 hours, and then you get Justice Hagedorn's, well, what if it's 5 minutes late? Maybe that's a better situation. Does the 5 minutes late, is that the, so the presumption is it affects their substantial rights because they have a right to have it, but it's late. So is it, in this case, is it rebutted? So is that a framework right. that incorporates sub C?
Okay, I understand, I think. So the presumption is that it is, you are prejudiced, that your substantial rights have been affected by a late filed examination report. But perhaps the county could come forward with evidence to rebut that presumption and say, actually, I verbally told defense counsel exactly what's in this report yesterday, or something like that. So that, am I understanding? Yes. Okay. That's an interesting approach that frankly I hadn't considered before this argument. I think there is a real benefit to clear rules in this context and to clear procedures and to remedying wrongs that Chapter 51 subjects are experiencing. You know, the late filed report problem, it is a real problem. It has occurred in prior cases. I'm sure it will occur again because, you know, for all sorts of just basic life reasons, sometimes we turn our homework in late. At the same time, it's not something that is across the board, causing trouble in this Chapter 51 domain. It's not something like dangerousness, which I'm sure this court sees PFR regarding dangerousness just about every day. So, creating a clear rule that will convey to the people involved in these cases that these reports are so significant that this clear rule the legislature has, established regarding defense counsel's access to these reports, that it has to be followed, and if it's not, the consequence will be either a loss of competency if the court takes that approach, or exclusion of the report and the expert's testimony if the court takes that approach. And I would just note, there are two examiners appointed by the court in these proceedings. So the fact that one has filed his or her report late should not make it impossible for the county to present the evidence they need to. Sometimes they also present evidence from the treating psychiatrist, whether it's at Winnebago or whatever facility the individual might be in. But by and large, we're talking about court-appointed examiners in these proceedings. And by and large, only one takes the stand at these trials. And so I would just say, maybe Dr. Bales was the county's first choice in this case, but it is not too high a price to ask the county to pay to go with its second choice when there has been this kind of violation.
Counsel, do counties ever submit, in your experience, two expert reports submitted on their behalf? I mean, one sort of for you.
I'm sorry, you broke up on my computer there. Could you?
Yeah, I'm sorry. In your experience, does the county ever submit more than one expert report sort of on its behalf? So you would have maybe three total that are submitted?
Okay, so you're saying beyond the two court-appointed examiners, does the county appoint a third? Never seen that.
Okay. Theoretically, the county could do that, I suppose, right?
I suppose they could at their expense. I don't know that there's anything barring it, but it is not a part of the procedure. I mean, the subject has the right to have an independent examiner, so a third examination report from the subject. But the county, I don't know that the statute contemplates that, and so I have never seen it. But I can't say it's not allowed.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. I wasn't sure how practically that plays out. I recognize the two are appointed. One of the things I was thinking about in relation to the competency issue is that if you did have two reports submitted by the county, the logical consequence of your competency argument that if one was late but one was not, the whole case would need to be dismissed. And that struck me as off from a competency perspective. But anyway, take that for what it may. You can respond to that if you want. It was just another way I was trying to think through this competency question of how central it is, because you can imagine the county providing. But I get in these cases, the reports are sort of the main part of the case. So anyway, I'll leave that for what it may. Respond if you'd like. If not, feel free to continue with your argument.
I would like to respond, but I just want to make sure I understand. So your concern is, competency, if a court is deprived of competency, then yes, the case should be dismissed. And your position is if one report was late, and then you said something about the other report, but I'm not sure.
I guess the other report being on time, right? So imagine the county still being able to prove its case.
Yes.
With one report being late.
I see.
So that the statutory scheme could still function, right?
I see.
It's not depriving your client of an additional minute of liberty in that situation, assuming even one was excluded, right? So you can imagine the scheme operating still even without that. So that's what I was pondering when we're dealing with this.
Right.
And admittedly, amorphous concept of central, central to the statutory scheme. So.
Right. Okay. I understand completely. And so I think one thing that the court should keep in mind is that there is lurking in the background this right to seek a continuance for up to 7 days. The subject has the right to seek a continuance for up to 7 days. And if we're in that situation, Justice Hagedorn, where we have one late report and one report that was filed on time, if the subject would prefer to rather than have the case dismissed and then recommenced and suffer through that whole thing again, if the subject would prefer to delay the hearing by a few days and cure the 48-hour issue there, then it is within the subject's right to do that. And then there will be 48 hours access to both reports, and there's no problem. That doesn't address the problem of when there's a subject who doesn't want to delay the hearing. And I would just say, the subject is the person whose liberty is at stake. This whole statutory scheme is built up around protecting that person's right to liberty and putting into place procedures that ensure fairness in these proceedings that are so, so important to people's lives. And when you get to that point where there has been a statutory violation, that it should not be the subject's burden to decide which due process deprivation he should suffer, whether it's prolonged detention or inadequate notice of the allegations and opinions that are going to be used against him. And so I think that is what competency recognizes. Competency recognizes that once we get to the point where the statutes have been violated, if these are the statutes that make due process rights real, then the case should be dismissed. And only if the subject wants to seek a continuance and cure the problem and take that approach will the case be able to remain alive. And my time is up.
Very much. Attorney Crocker, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Yes, please begin.
May it please the court, I am Chelsea Brocker, Assistant Corporation Counsel for Fond du Lac County, and I wanted to note in the room with me is Megan McNamara, who is the Corporation Counsel for Fond du Lac County as well. So today we are requesting that this court uphold the circuit court's decision that S&W met the criteria for a commitment and was a danger to himself or others. The county admits this was largely based off of a report by Dr. Bales, which was 24 hours prior to the final hearing, which is in a violation of 51 subsection 10B. As the Justice Hagedorn stated, however, the legislator has contemplated this type of situation by including 5120 subsection 10C, as well as 5120 subsection 10E. C does state that the court is to disregard any error or defect in the proceedings that don't affect the substantial rights of either party. Further, the subject S&W or his counsel could have requested a 7-day extension if they felt fit.
So counsel, you would put the burden then on S&W to request an adjournment because the state is the one that, or the county is the one that didn't turn over the report on time, forcing S&W to choose between additional time in custody or their counsel being prepared. How is that something that this statute would contemplate?
And respectfully, it's not the county that turned over this report late. These are court-appointed evaluators. Who the circuit court in this case was a result of a very late venue change. The circuit court had 3 days to set a final hearing and find two independent evaluators that were willing to take this appointment and do a good evaluation and submit it. So I understand, your point. However, with that being said, it wasn't necessarily the county's burden. It was the circuit court's burden to get these appointed.
Well, does it matter whose burden it is when the way that the statutory language is stated is that counsel for the person to be committed shall have access? It doesn't say county and it doesn't say circuit court. You are correct, but it contemplates access, right? So who bears the burden? Your comment, and I know you focused on it in your brief, is that, well, they just can ask for an adjournment. But doesn't that put the defense counsel and S&W in this case in a bad spot of losing liberty or potentially being prepared? And is that really what the statute contemplates in light of 10C?
I think that the statute is contemplating whether or not the trial court to weigh whether or not substantial rights were affected by S&W. I know that isn't directly answering your question, but this is a right afforded to S&W to request a 7-day extension. If he felt that, or his counsel felt they didn't have adequate time to prepare with that report, then they could have requested that 7-day extension. It is not something afforded to the circuit court, namely, or the county. I do appreciate S&W's point that his liberty was at stake. However, he also could have requested to be discharged to the outpatient. That never came up at the hearing. And the circumstances of this case are very unfortunate, and I appreciate the fact that these reports came in late. The circuit court was in a very tight place, though, getting these doctors evaluated. We have a very small pool of doctors that are willing to do these reports, and very even small number that would be willing to do these reports within a day's notice.
And so could you address your opposing counsel in response to the idea of sort of showing, you know, substantial rights were violated, or I'm not sure where the burden would be or how you'd think through that question. But she was talking about, you know, listen, what are we supposed to say? We just got this. We didn't have time to, you know, we didn't realize. I mean, and I heard your opposing counsel say we didn't know about the danger to others until we received Dr. Bale's report. And so just that would be practically difficult to make some sort of showing outside of, darn it, we're scrambling here, and this thing is happening in a day. How do you respond to some of those concerns that have been raised? And if you have any thoughts on practically how this might play out and how these statutes interact, I'd certainly be welcome to hear your thoughts as well on that.
Sure, thank you. Yes, and I did want to touch specifically on the fact that counsel wasn't aware that what specific dangerousness was going to be addressed. The emergency detention states that the person is being alleged to be a danger to themselves or others. So it is in the emergency detention. Further, counsel has access to all of Winnebago Mental Health's treatment records, as well as the jails, Dodge County jails. So they would have access to all of the records stating in this specific case that SNW was restrained due to the fact that he was making threats towards others. Tying into, though, whether or not how the court can determine if the substantial rights of SNW were affected, I do think that is something the circuit court would need to weigh based off of the facts and circumstances of the case. And I greatly appreciate it would be hard to come in and say, hey, well, we didn't know specifically a certain aspect with only 24 hours to investigate the case. I do appreciate that. With that being said, this court has addressed this in several cases, namely State v. Kiwanda S., which stated as well as in Ray the termination of Jayden S., which the court said that there has to be a reasonable outcome or a reasonable possibility that the outcome of the action was affected due to that late report or evidence in this case. So I do think that there needs to be some sort of showing that there was some sort of prejudice or bias in that specific State v. Kiwanda case. Yes.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I struggle with here, and I was trying to nail this down from a research perspective, but and I get the substantial rights language when it comes to appellate court review is often looking at some sort of harmless error analysis. That seems that's very different when you're pre-hearing and you're trying to determine that. Now, there's something, you know, so you're not retrospectively going back and saying what the results have been different. You're looking and saying, is this prejudicing the party right now who's about to enter into a hearing, you know, on this question? So I think those cases dealing with appellate review have a very different application than a statute, which pretty clearly applies to the circuit court determining defects or errors at any stage of the proceeding, including before the hearing takes place.
Yes, and you are completely accurate with that. In this specific case, that's all I can really opine on, and applying that to maybe larger cases, is there was no smoking gun or anything that people wouldn't have had access to through the Winnebago Mental Health treatment records. However, I mean, for your sake, I could give an example of where I could see this happening. For example, if you got a report 24 hours or 12 hours prior to a final hearing and it said, hey, yesterday the subject punched the doctor, and we didn't include that in our inpatient records, that could definitely be something where counsel could argue their substantial rights were being affected because they were not aware of that specific issue happening and they were not in any records they would have had access to. So I can appreciate that can happen.
Counsel, do you in a case like this, where the trial counsel or trial judge, the circuit court judge, said that this was a very close case and that he was basing his decision on that report that was filed late and within 24 hours, wouldn't this be a situation where pre-hearing, it's such a close call? Or maybe he hears it and realizes it's such a close call that wouldn't this be the situation that there could have been a different outcome? It was possible to have a different outcome if that report was excluded. If the report had been given in a timely manner, perhaps counsel could have done more to sway him the other way.
Sure, and I appreciate that. However, in this case, when I'm looking at this, that the report by Dr. Bales said absolutely nothing different than what it would have said if it was provided 48 hours prior to the prior hearing. Additionally, if the report would have been excluded, there was still testimony, and I do know what you're citing to in the transcript. The judge said that based off of what the report said, that was what solidified the dangerousness for SNW. What he was testifying to only elaborated when contributing that to the report. So I believe that they went hand in hand at the trial court level in this case. So in this specific case, I continue to go back to the fact that the report wouldn't have said anything different if it was 48 hours prior to the final hearing or 24 hours prior to the final hearing.
Whether the report would have said something different, isn't the question whether defense counsel was unable to be adequately prepared? And that is a tough question to ask. How will you ever know ahead of time? But in a case like this, where it's such a close call, maybe an extra 24 hours would have made all the difference, right?
In this case, respectfully, I don't think it would have. The dangerousness in this specific case, there was specific citing of Winnebago mental health records, which is what the doctor largely based his report off of, that SNW was saying specific threats to staff at Winnebago Mental Health, that he was put in restraints. In this case, I don't believe preparation for those type of things would have made a difference.
Counsel, your opposing counsel has discussed the two remedies, so to speak, that were available here. One would be exclusion of the report and testimony, and the other is to request the 7-day postponement, which can be granted only upon the subject's request. And so your opposing counsel frames this question, since the only thing in play here is really there was the objection to the admission of the report and testimony. That's what we're focused on. And the issue is presented according to your opposing counsel. Then we review that exercise of discretion. Appropriate exercise of discretion. Did the circuit court appropriately deny the request? Your opposing counsel advances that it was not an appropriate exercise of discretion and states that the circuit court failed to apply any law at all. And normally, of course, exercise of discretion is that you apply a proper standard of law, apply the facts, and come to a reasoned result. And your opposing counsel said, no, the circuit court failed to apply any law at all, and it reached an unfair result. Can you respond to those assertions? The first one, the circuit court failed to apply any law.
Sure, yes. So I will admit the circuit court judge asked counsel for SNW and myself, if we were aware of any specific law on point. We both acknowledged we were not aware of any law. The circuit court then looked at the facts that this case was a result of a very late venue change, and it left the circuit court 3 days to set for a final hearing and get independent evaluations in. And based off of that, he was not going to exclude the evidence and proceed. So to be honest, the circuit court, I'm not aware, did apply specific law. With that being said, he did look at the facts and circumstances of the case and felt that it was appropriate to proceed and allow that evidence in. Additionally, I wanted to also note that with the fact that the circuit court did weigh the totality of the circumstances, which I do think is what is appropriate to be done in these types of cases. I continually keep reiterating this was a very rare circumstance. I cannot think of a case that I've ever had where a venue change occurred 3 days prior to a final hearing. We are limited in the amount of doctors we have available to do these independent evaluations and are willing to accept them. And even to that greater extent, I can think of a number of doctors that would have said no with that such short of an evaluation to be done.
Counsel, with regard to the law, your opposing counsel cites to the Sandra D case. And what is your response to that? You've also cited to that in your brief. And,
yes, I did.
Of what import is that to a legal premise that's up that we have to consider here?
Sure. And I did cite to that, and I don't think the circuit court necessarily should have factored in that case either. That case is significantly different than this case. The person in that case, first off, it's a Chapter 54-55 case. That person was detained for 63 days, and a doctor report never came in. That is drastically different than a 24-hour late report. A report did come in this case, and it really wouldn't have changed anything if it had come in 48 hours prior to. So I do not think that case applies to this at all. I also wanted to touch on that I do believe a dismissal or that the finding that a court lost competency to proceed would be the incorrect result here. The county and the circuit court are tasked with ensuring S&W's own safety as well as the community's. And that is what the court was weighing. The reports showed that S&W, as well as the emergency detention, showed that S&W was likely not in a good state and not caring for himself as well as a danger to other people. Regarding the dangerousness, the trial court did weigh the testimony and facts and found that S&W was a danger to himself or others. Dr. Bales gave specific examples of threats and that he was posturing towards staff. He noted that S&W, there was record of him saying, "You've got it coming, boy." And staff was in fear of their own safety, and he had to be restrained at that point in the inpatient setting. This court has also touched on Marathon County v. DK, that the statute does not require certainty that a person would be a danger to himself or others. And rather, there has to be a substantial probability of physical harm to others. And it requires a showing that is much more likely than not that an individual will cause physical harm to others. This can be shown that at least one person was placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior or serious physical harm, and that the statute doesn't require certainty or an expert to be clairvoyant. So based off of that, the circuit court did find 5120 1A2B was satisfied that S&W was a substantial probability of harm to others or himself, or I'm sorry, a harm to others in this specific case. Regarding mootness, I also wanted to touch on that as well. I did argue in my brief that I do believe this case is moot. However, I do acknowledge this court may find that it meets one of the mootness exceptions. If that is the case, I would ask that this case, I do not believe, needs to be decided on the merits of the case, as it wouldn't have a practical effect on the appellant because SNW has, his orders have expired and he is now deceased as well. And I do feel regarding the dangerousness, this court has decided other case law that is very informative to the dangerousness evaluations that can assist the circuit court in those type of determinations.
So just to be clear, so you're asking we forget competency, we forget remedies, we forget dangerousness as issues in this case, and just say it's moot and get dispose of the case in that fashion. Is that what you're asking?
That is what I am requesting. However, I do acknowledge that this court may find an exception to mootness to give the circuit court some, the circuit courts around the state some assistance in determining when a late report may occur. However, a late report, 48-hour violation is not something that frequently occurs. In my time, this has actually never occurred, and I've been with the county for 6.5 years. This is the first time this has ever happened. In any of my cases, the only time this has happened is in Chapter 55 cases, and those are normally the independent evaluators requested by the ward. So this is not something that frequently happens. It was an unfortunate circumstance that occurred because of this late venue change. Our doctors are very good at knowing that these reports need to come in. And if they don't feel they can meet that timeline, they will not take the evaluation. Additionally, I wanted to also note on Wisconsin Statute 805.18, which states that no judgment shall be reversed or set aside on the grounds of improper admission of evidence or for the error in pleading or procedure, unless the examination of the entire record, the court finds that the error affected the substantial rights. That is very similar to 5120 subsection 10C.
The whole commitment sure seemed to be based on Dr. Bale's report. So if we do find a problem with that we might have a real issue in terms of the outcome of the proceeding. That begs the question as to whether his report should have been admitted or not, or was permissibly admitted or not. If we get to that point that it was improperly admitted, then I think we probably have a problem here, since the circuit court relied pretty extensively on his report and his findings.
Yes, and I would agree with you at that point. The testimony in the report is what the circuit court largely made the determination that SNW was a danger to himself or others. In this case specifically, there isn't an issue of whether he is mentally ill or a suitable candidate for treatment, but I can appreciate if the court rules that that report should have been excluded, then likely a commitment wouldn't have been granted. However, again, that goes back to my prior point that mootness is a factor in this case as well that I believe this court would need to determine as well. The additional note I wanted to make was these independent evaluations, the circuit court is who appoints those, as I previously stated. The subject is also able to give a recommendation of who they would like one of those independent evaluators to be. In this case specifically, I'm not sure if that happened. With that being said, because of that short notice, frequently, however, in many cases, when a subject requests a certain doctor, they are looking forward to getting that report because often, frequently enough, these reports can come in and be in favor of the individual to some extent or another. For example, they may say that the person isn't a suitable candidate for a medication order. They could say the person's a suitable candidate to be outpatient. They could say that they're a suitable candidate for a settlement agreement, all lesser restrictive type orders. So when those reports come in, both councils are looking at those to determine what we're recommending. If we were order, if this court were to order that those reports should be excluded, in all cases, the subject may, that may not be something in favor of the subject. And so I don't think it is a good outcome for dismissal of the case, but even at that, for dismissal or exclusion of one of the doctor reports, because that will cut both ways. Additionally, I wanted to note if these reports, if Dr. Bales in this specific case were to get this report done so quickly and not be able to go in depth and do a deep dive into records because they're concerned that their report will be excluded, I'm not sure how thorough that report will be. These reports by these doctors are based off of, yes, and a one-to-one evaluation of that patient, but even more so, it's looking at all of the records that they can obtain from Winnebago Mental Health in this example, but also if somebody has outpatient treatment, it may also be to look at their outpatient doctor, which could be at several different facilities. So I'm not sure how thorough these reports will be if these doctors are concerned that their reports will be excluded. Additionally, I wanted to note that these reports are largely, well, not largely, they are completely funded by the county and the circuit court. So to exclude them also causes some budgetary issues as well. Now, I understand that doesn't eliminate the rights of SNW to have a report excluded and have his substantial rights protected. With that being said, I do think it's something this court needs to consider as well, that there are some budgetary things going on as well. And so, for example, if the county were to provide like a third report, as Justice Hagedorn stated, there would be budgetary consequences to that as well.
Where I'm having a hard time understanding these policy arguments, not that I don't understand the policy that you're arguing, but I don't understand how that's supposed to factor into our decision.
Well, I think as a practical standpoint, I think whether or not reports come in and if they're in favor of the subject, I think that is an important thing to consider in this type of case. Because it does happen frequently. I understand that that's not, that's why I do believe the circuit courts needs to have discretion of whether or not the ward's substantial rights or either party's substantial rights were affected. Because it's something that the trial court could weigh whether or not the report came in favor of the subject, for example. Perhaps the county would be the one requesting exclusion of a report. But if the report came in and it was in favor of the subject, the trial court would need to weigh that.
Well, I think in the situation that you're, I think in that example, if the county's coming, is going to submit a report that is going to somehow be in favor of, the subject, that is when that subsection 10 would kick in and they could ask for a 7-day continuance. So I'm not following your argument.
Yes, that is true. They could. However, they may not want to. That is not something we can force them to do. So I don't, they possibly would not want to request a 7-day extension if they are inpatient at that time. We're also dealing with people that are mentally ill, so it's unpredictable what they would request. So based off of that, I am requesting that this court uphold the circuit court's decision that S&W was found to be a danger to others and that his substantial rights were not affected with the 1-day late report of the independent evaluation done by Dr. Bales. And I would request this court affirm the Fond du Lac County Circuit Court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, are you prepared for rebuttal?
I am.
Please begin.
I want to start by returning to the substantial right issue. The substantial right that the 48-hour rule serves is the substantial right to an opportunity to prepare a defense. When we think about the report versus the sorts of discovery items that opposing counsel was referring to, which I'll note, nowhere in the record does it clarify what she had access to in discovery. But if you think about those sorts of things, the discovery documents she might have obtained, and then you think about the report, you can kind of analogize that to criminal discovery in the criminal complaint. What gives a defendant notice of the charges that he's going to have to defend himself against? It's the particular allegations in the complaint, not the big stack of police reports that he gets in discovery. And here, you know, there is, at a certain point, a defense attorney needs to understand the specifics of what she is rebutting, whether that's expert opinions, factual allegations, or both. And the examination reports are what provide that information to defense counsel in these cases, almost across the board. Although just yesterday I looked at this court's most recent 4 or 5 decisions in original commitment cases. In every single one, a court-appointed examiner was a critical witness. In a couple, court-appointed examiner was the only witness. I then looked at a couple of recommitment cases that I cited in my briefs. Specifically, I think it was DJW and JWJ. Again, one witness, a court-appointed examiner. In these cases, these examination reports and the psychiatrists who write them are everything. We can't underestimate the significance of getting timely access to the evidence that is what we will be defending against. On that note, I also want to comment, you know, this sort of returns to Justice Hagedorn and Justice Dalit's point about, well, what if it's 5 minutes late? We're talking about 48 hours. That is so little time. Chapter 51 subjects are, generally speaking, represented by public defenders with sky-high caseloads, with urgent tasks and deadlines in all of those various cases. 48 hours means there is a window of time. 2 days, it's not a lot by any means, but 2 days in which a public defender can carve out some time to sufficiently prepare for this extremely important case in which their client's liberty is on the line.
Counsel, can you briefly address the mootness? I understand that opposing counsel is in one county. You may see cases from more than one county. Do reports get filed late sometimes?
Do reports get filed late sometimes? Yes. I would agree with Attorney Brocker that it's not a super common problem, thankfully. But they do get filed late sometimes. I believe my petition for review in this case cited one or two or maybe three unpublished Court of Appeals decisions dealing with late filed reports. So this is not the first time the appellate courts have had to confront the question of what happens with those 48-hour, a violation of the 48-hour rule. I'll also note those previous Court of Appeals opinions seem to go the other way from this one, which is one of the reasons I sought this court's review on this issue. So yes, it's something that does happen. And yes, I see cases from the entire state. Okay. Beyond that, just a couple more comments on mootness. Obviously, my client passed away before this court granted review. This is a novel statutory interpretation issue. It's obviously a difficult one. It's one the circuit court here didn't know how to deal with. It's one the Court of Appeals in other cases have come to different conclusions on. So it's certainly one that this court, you know, that warrants this court's review on the merits. I think this court presumably agrees by granting review. I do know that there is floating out there in other cases the question of whether a Chapter 51 appeal can ever be moot. I just wanted to note, because I didn't have the opportunity to brief that per se, and Attorney Brocker hasn't had the opportunity to address that, this probably isn't the case to take that issue up. Frankly, I don't know that there's any need to delve into whether that anything in here is moot at all, because it is so clear that exceptions, multiple exceptions to the mootness doctrine apply.
Also, on the mootness question, I broadly agree, but there is this question of do we need to get to the evidence on dangerousness issue, or maybe even whether Dr. Bale's report was rightly admitted or not. Are you comfortable with us not answering those questions, but nonetheless answering the broader question of how to think about sub B, whether that's a competency issue or not, and if there's a violation, what the proper remedy would be moving forward?
No, I would say, and I do see my time is up, but I'll answer your question, Justice Hagedorn. First of all, I think it certainly is important that the court address the broader problem of what circuit courts in general should do with these 48-hour rule violations and how this particular kind of dangerousness, how it should address that. But I do have a client. I understand he's passed away, but he is my client, and he pursued this appeal because he felt he had been wronged, because he felt that both statutorily and in terms of the substance of the dangerousness finding, he had been wronged. He cited the collateral consequences of his commitment when he pursued his initial appeal, and then while it was pending, he passed away. I would assert that he continues to have a right to a resolution of his case, despite the fact that he has passed away, for some of the reasons alluded to in this court's, I believe it was DJW, in mostly in a footnote. There's a little bit of discussion of that issue of the death of a subject with a pending appeal. And I think that analysis applies here, and I would ask the court to rule on the merits and to decide the specifics of this case, not just the broader questions presented. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for very interesting arguments and for fine briefs. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 15 minutes past 11. We are adjourned.